court is ready to hear argument from relator in Alford Chevrolet Geo and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark L. Perlmutter and Mr. William W. Kilgar will present argument to the relator. The relator has reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Perlmutter will open the first 9 minutes. Mr. Kilgar will also present rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is potentially a class action of immense proportions involving the purchase of over 4 million vehicles since January of 1994. The issues that we ask the court to consider today is whether the putative class representatives have met the DPPA notice requirements and whether the defendants may be subjected to merits discovery before a class is certified.
Is there any problem with any of the judges on this court being possible future members of the class?
Potentially, Your Honor. We don't see that as a problem, but certainly being car buyers since December of 1994, or January of 1994, possibly one of the justices might have conflict.
Well, can we trust it to the parties if anybody has a problem with that? Some of the judges have cars newer than that, and some I know don't. But.
Sorry. I'm with those that know.
If you go back to 84, I might be.
Can we trust it that one of the parties will mention that to us if they want us to make an inquiry?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Silence will be assent.
Yeah, you have our assent. I think I can speak for our side on that.
How few judges will you accept as a panel?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. I said, how few judges will you accept as a panel?
I guess it depends on who they are. Judge Chagallin is going to address the discovery issues, and I'm going to talk about the DPPA issues here at the beginning. In order to determine whether the other side met the notice requirements.
Before we go too much into the argument, we sent you back to talk, and nobody gave us a report about, you know, what we asked about and why this is important to the jurisprudence.
Let me see if I can answer that, Your Honor. Specifically, first for the DPPA issues.
Yeah.
For the DPPA issues, there's no agreement. Our position is still that the DPPA requires notice for the individual plaintiffs before a class action can proceed. The plaintiffs in the case don't agree with that position, so there's a clear disparity. Under your opinion and our Judge Heck's opinion for the entire court at times versus Hash mandamus we submitted is still appropriate for that. On the discovery issues, we had offered a counter stipulation, and our counter stipulation was that any discovery reasonably calculated to lead to admissible evidence related to class certification would be permissible, but that would not include evidence that was primarily related to establishment or proof of liability and damages, and we couldn't agree on that verdict. So that's where the discussion ended.
So if the request is any documents that any of the dealers have where they charge this tax, you agree that would be trying to identify the class members?
Yeah, it would be, Your Honor, but then
okay.
we would stipulate.
So that's not part of the documents that you're in disagreement over?
Well, actually it is, Your Honor, because our position is that we would stipulate to the numerosity requirement, and it's not necessary to identify every class member prior to certification, because that's an extraordinarily expensive process. Once certification occurred, if it did, then it would be appropriate to do that.
Okay, so you're willing to stipulate that it's a large class that has similar factual background?
No. That part we don't agree with necessarily. We're certainly willing to stipulate to the numerosity with regard to the typicality and commonality issues. There are certainly some issues that need to be decided, but the discovery necessary to deal with those issues is quite minimal. If I might return to the DPPA issues and let Judge Phil Garland answer any more detailed questions about the other.
It sounds to me that as if you're arguing that you have to give notice related to the class reps or the individual plaintiffs.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The defendants can always then try to settle with them, and maybe you would always thwart class certification completely.
I don't think always that would occur. I think certainly that can occur if the defendants choose to make the tender required under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And that's certainly an eventuality that could occur. That's precisely the eventuality that is mandated by the clear wording of the statute. There is no room in the statute to provide notice for an uncertified class on behalf of all these class representatives. As we point out in the brief, notice is required from the consumer advising the defendant of the nature of the consumer-specific complaint.
So no more consumer class action?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that.
How would it work then? How would you ever have a consumer class action? How would you ever comply with the notice requirement? Is this all supposed to occur pre-certification?
Your Honor, there's actually one consumer class that's gone up on appeal in Houston. There's a case against H&R Block where apparently they dealt with the notice issues and it's been certified and the appeal
is made. How are you telling us it would work?
Well, it would work if somebody made demand under the DTPA and the defendant failed to make the required tender, and that happens from time to time. I handle more cases like these as plaintiff, frankly, and I can tell this court that it's a rare occasion when an individual demand like that is actually answered and a full tender is made. It's a rare case where that happens.
But on a related topic, essentially you would have to identify in the notice letter the names of all the plaintiffs to the putative class, and that would be probably an impossibility.
Well, Your Honor, under the DTPA, the way we read the statute, and I think the statute's clear on this, prior to filing suit, you know all the plaintiffs that you represent. In this case, there are five of them involving four transactions. They can clearly make a demand on behalf of those five plaintiffs prior to filing suit. Once certification occurs, at that point, you can discover and find the notice.
But I'm talking pre-certification in a consumer class action brought under the DTPA. Because virtually always you will not know the names of all the putative class members, you cannot make a demand on behalf of all the putative class members.
That's correct, Your Honor. You really couldn't. Well, first of all, because you wouldn't have authority to represent them. Secondly, because you wouldn't know who they were.
On this authority issue, wouldn't that be true in all class actions?
Yeah.
Consumer and non-consumer.
Well, now, it's a little different. It's a little different because in other class actions, even though you don't have authority to represent the class, quote-unquote, settlement discussions informally can take place, but before any settlement's approved or any offers are officially made or accepted, the class has to be certified.
And why can that not be done? Why can those negotiations not be done in the consumer class action context?
They could be, but that doesn't deny that if proper notice is not made on behalf of the four identified plaintiffs, and that notice is not done properly, then the defendants are entitled to abatement. You can still have informal discussions about that any time you want, presumably. But that doesn't preclude the defendant's right to abate the case if proper notice is not made.
But, I mean, just because it's a consumer class action, there is no difference between the representation by the lawyer of unnamed plaintiffs versus the non-consumer class action.
Well, in terms of making demands and receiving a response, I submit there certainly is a difference because the specific provisions of the DTPA require a notice on behalf of an individual defendant, on behalf of an individual plaintiff to an individual defendant. And Section 17.506, damage defenses, is a clear expression of intent by the legislature to give a defendant an opportunity to tender the full amount of the plaintiff's claim to terminate the litigation at that point. And there's not any way that I can see other than legislative amendment to change that. 17.506 says that in an action brought under 1750, it is a defense to a cause of action if the defendant proves he received notice from the consumer advising the defendant of the consumer's specific complaint, and so forth and so on, and tenders and attorney's fees reasonably incurred by the consumer in asserting the claim against the defendant, and it was then 30 days after the day on which the defendant receives the notice, the defendant tendered to the consumer the amount of economic damages and damages for mental anguish claim and the expenses including attorney's fees if any reasonably incurred by the consumer in asserting the claim.
In this case, why could the defendant companies not tender the amount of this identified tax, I realize it's not exactly a tax, but what is labeled a tax, why couldn't all the car dealers tender that back to everyone they charged that from? And the, what is it now, $110,000 attorney's fees, and therefore you would have set up your statutory defense.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I don't think there's anything that requires the defendants to take that action until a class is certified. If, as far as the individual defendants are concerned, or the individual claims in this case, the reason why we haven't tendered is because one of the prerequisites of our power to end the litigation by tendering is our proving. That is, the defendant has to prove we received a notice from the consumer advising us of the complaint, the amount of economic damages and expenses, including attorney's fees, reasonably incurred by the consumer in asserting the claim. So we've got to prove that they made a demand for reasonable attorney's fees and expenses, and that we satisfied it 100%. They haven't given us an opportunity, on behalf of the individual plaintiffs, they haven't given us an opportunity to do that. What they did instead in their first letter is they asked for $50 million on behalf of the entire class and $75,000 in attorney's fees. In the second letter, they asked for $110,000 and $47,000 in case expenses. Now, remember that if the court will, that this is anticipated to be a pre-suit notice. And if you're including $47,000 of case expenses and service fees and so forth, that's not a pre-suit notice. So the key to this is that they've got to trigger our ability to tender by a proper notice letter. And that's what they haven't done in this case. And we've been waiting now 3 years over multiple suits, multiple counties, with multiple dollars to get a proper notice letter so that we can make that tender if we so choose it. We haven't had that opportunity. We spent $10,000.
You could have. You could have taken the letter the way it was written, and under your view, you could have paid $150 to the plaintiffs, and you could have paid $75,000 to the lawyer and let them come forward and claim that that wasn't sufficient tender. And then we'd be in the process of arguing whether or not the tender satisfied the DTPA. Your argument being, well, their letter, that's all their letter could possibly require to us because it wasn't a certified class, or they'd say our letter was sufficient. You'd argue, no, it wasn't sufficient. So if we didn't tender, it wasn't sufficient. We'd be down the road with these.
Your Honor, I certainly appreciate the logic of that argument. I would submit to the court, though, that the statute doesn't require us to guess that much. What would happen to every defendant is we would have to absolutely guess out of whole cloth how much money really did relate to their attorney's fees in order to get this tender defense. Now, if they were required by this court to tender, to make a demand for attorney's fees reasonably incurred by the consumer in asserting the claim against the defendant, which is obviously not what they've done, they narrow the range that we've got to guess within. There's no way they
That goes to the argument whether or not you've made an adequate tender. That doesn't go to the argument whether or not their letter is sufficient.
Well, I submit that it goes to the argument about whether the letter is sufficient. Here's why. Their letter is required to include attorney's fees reasonably incurred by the consumer in asserting the claim against the defendant. Now, does that mean they can wait 2 years after they file a suit, incur $100,000 worth of fees, $50,000 worth of expenses, and say, okay, those were the fees that were reasonably incurred by the consumer in asserting the claim against the defendant?
But that doesn't go to the adequacy of the letter. That goes to the reasonableness of the fee. You could, surely, under the DTPA, the defendant could not take the position that I didn't have to tender because I didn't like the amount of the attorney's fees they put in the letter. It seems to me that's the argument you get into as to whether or not your tender was sufficient.
If I might, there are two different statutes that we're talking about here. One of them is Section 17506, and that's a total defense to any liability termination litigation. The one that I think the court's argument really relates to is the one that allows you to cap the damages, where they can ask for a gazillion dollars, and you say, well, I really think their damages are $30 here, and their attorney's fees are $250, and if I end up being right, they don't get any more attorney's fees or damages when the case is over. The problem is that while all of that's going, and we could have done that in this case, but that doesn't serve us, because while the case is going on, we're spending a fortune defending this case and dealing with 4 million car sales and this class certification and all this stuff over a class, by the way, that I don't think will ever be certified. But we're spending all that money doing that when, and because that defense doesn't do us any good. The one that does us any good is 17506, and that's why I submit to this, that this court ought to say that in making a request or making a demand under 17506, we're talking about fees reasonably incurred in making a pre-suit demand on behalf of each individual plaintiff against any, each defendant from whoever that plaintiff seeks recovery.
But your position here is that they have not given you a proper DTPA demand.
That's right, Your Honor.
And, but all your argument is the reasonableness, at least at this point, the reasonableness of the fee. We're talking about the attorney's fees now.
No, it's what the fees are related to, Your Honor.
But
it's
again,
not reasonable. I'm not saying that $110,000 and $50,000 in expenses is unreasonable for pursuing a class action at this point. What I am saying is that's the demand that they made. But the fees that they're complaining or that they're asking for don't relate to the individual claims by these individual plaintiffs.
How do you know that?
I think it's perfectly obvious from the amounts. We know that there's not any way that they could have spent $47,000 in pursuing claims on behalf of these individual plaintiffs, because they spent about that serving the 600 defendants in this case that don't have any transactional relationship specifically with any of these plaintiffs in the case. They've spent $110,000. There's no way, as a plaintiff's lawyer who testifies as an expert on attorney's fees, I'll submit to this court that there's not any way that I have ever or anybody else could ever make any kind of a colorable claim that $110,000 is necessary to assert a pre-suit claim on behalf of a consumer under these circumstances.
And before you get an abatement under the DTPA, I mean, before the plaintiff is permitted to proceed on a DTPA action, the trial court's going to have a hearing to determine the reasonableness of the attorney's fees on the demand of the DTPA. If the trial court determines that that was a reasonable fee that they made on the DTPA, then you don't get the abatement, or if the trial court, I mean, what do we have to do in order to determine the adequacy of the DTPA notice? Is there some sort of fact hearing over reasonableness of
the fees? The fact hearing would be, is this court would set a standard, presumably, or to interpret the law, as I believe it's intended, and that is to say that what we mean by fees and expenses reasonably incurred by the consumer in asserting the claim against them, what we mean by that is reasonably incurred by the consumer in presenting a pre-suit demand, reasonably incurred by the consumer in presenting a pre-suit demand. I don't think they make any pretension that that's what the fees and expenses that they've incurred in this case were incurred for. The court sets that standard, and the trial court decides whether the demand letter asked for the fees and expenses reasonably incurred in making the pre-suit demand, and that's the factual inquiry. But the trial court needs guidance from this court, because no court's ever talked about this. These notice letters, we just operate blindly, and as a plaintiff and as a defendant, we continue to operate blindly on these things. And the jurisprudence of this state needs this court's guidance on what's a proper demand letter. A
couple of quick questions. Mm-hmm. Are you requesting abatement for what has been identified as the Class B defendants, those who did not file verified motions for abatement?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Abatement for everybody. Abatement for everybody, because notice was not proper as to anybody.
All right. And clarify the facts surrounding the situation where there was an automatic abatement letter was given, and then supposedly the case was unabated automatically. Or what is the current status of the position that is argued by the plaintiff?
There were certain defendants that filed verified pleadings, and their cases were automatically abated. The defendants, or the plaintiffs in this case, just ignored that and kept serving discovery and going forward with the case. And so we filed a plea and abatement to enforce, basically, the court's jurisdiction and maintain the abatement that we think is already automatically provided for.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. A little about 5 minutes for co-counsel to present an argument.
Do I have any time left?
We're giving you 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to acknowledge my other co-counsel in this case, Bill Eichert, and Mike Byrne, and Lynn Liberato, and Alain Levy of Haynes and Boone. Going first to the question that was addressed to us, The test in mandamus is not as important to the jurisdiction of the state. I mean, that's a test on granting a writ of error.
Well, it's in the footnote of Walker and Packer that we can exercise our discretion in that regard in deciding whether or not to grant a mandamus.
Hopefully exercise your discretion by hearing us up to this point, Your Honor. What is important and what is underlying any mandamus proceeding is whether or not the trial judge has abused his or her discretion. On 78 different occasions since the adoption of Rule 166B on April 1, 1984, this court has granted leave to file a writ of mandamus in a discovery case. In 75 of those 78 mandamus proceedings, this court has held that the trial judge has abused his or her discretion in the discovery ruling. This court has ruled on seven separate occasions in overbroad discovery, just as recently as American Optical, that overbroad discovery is an abuse of discretion. Case law in this state and federal cases, and I might point out that Justice Baker wrote an opinion when on the Dallas court, that says that federal case law is more than advisory. Federal case law, because it interprets the rule from which Rule 42 was taken, is persuasive on our proceedings. Case law says that class certification hearings shall be devoted to determining the issues of certification. Just recently in the dissent in Dawson-Austin versus Austin, Justice Baker, joined by Justices Ian and Abbott, said this language as to the special appearances. As a policy matter, litigants should not engage in discovery on the merits of other issues until the special appearance is decided. Class certification is no different from special appearances. Class certification, you first inquire as to should this class be certified. You know, the whole problem here, and I wish I had more time, but Justice Gonzalez put his finger on it in his concurring opinion in CSR versus Link. What you're doing to defendants in these cases when you allow for massive discovery before you get to the issue is you are permitting the compelling, the forcing of settlement. It's cheaper to buy your way out. That's what happened on sanctions when we had death penalty sanctions up until Transamerica was decided. Trial judge administered a death penalty sanction and it forced a settlement on the part of the defendants and what they may have had a meritorious case.
Why is the other side's compromise inadequate?
Excuse me, sir?
Why is the other side's compromise inadequate?
That's no compromise at all. It says it relates just to the smallest degree, to certification, then it's going to be permissible. Well, I can craft any question and argue.
Is there any difference in the relief you're requesting from this court in this mandamus proceeding?
I'm sorry. I'm getting a little hard of hearing in my old age.
Why is their offer of compromise any different than the relief that you're requesting from this court by mandamus?
Their offer of compromise is no compromise at all, Your Honor, if you read their proposed
But as I read the mandamus papers in this suit, you're asking us to order the trial judge to bifurcate discovery as to class certification issue and merit.
That's correct.
And the request is no more specific than that.
Well, if you want us to fashion for you,
now,
the proposed rules change to Rule 42, we'll do it.
Now, my question is, why is the compromise any different than what you're requesting with respect to the relief?
Well, let's go back to Rule 166B. Take the broad language there in 166B. You know, we're not drawing bright lines for trial judges to follow, but we are setting the philosophy. We say it's got to be relevant
and the discovery has to lead to something that's admissible. Let this court set the philosophy for discovery in regards to class certification, and then let the trial judges follow it. Right now, the trial judges have got no guidelines whatsoever as far as allowing discovery in class certification.
Let me ask you this specific question, and maybe this is, it gives me some difficulty. You've got Alford Chevrolet Geo. The only question that seems to me is what people are arguing about is whether or not Alford Chevrolet Geo should have to produce the pieces of paper that show the purchasers of an automobile who paid a tax. And the argument, it seems to me, is Alford says, I don't want to produce that because that goes to the merits. And the plaintiffs say, no, that document goes to the class certification. We're determining the size of the class. Mr. Perlmutter responds, well, you don't need to know the name of the class member. You just need to know how many there are, and we'll concede that there's lots of them. Now, is that what this is all about? Is that really the details of this case is whether or not Alford is going to have to produce the pieces of paper that show what customer bought a car that the tax was taxed on? Is that, we're just saying, I don't want to produce those because that's merits, and the other side, I need them because it works on this class. Is that really kind of what we're talking about?
No, sir, that's not what we're talking about. I'm not going to enumerate everything in Judge Parrish's order. We have been required to identify all purchasers, sales managers, and finance insurance employees having knowledge of relevant facts. You're talking about 4 million sales of vehicles. We've got to identify every purchaser, every sales manager, finance, insurance employee having knowledge of relevant facts. And moreover, contrary to case law, we've got to state what their knowledge of relevant facts is. That can't possibly relate to certification. I mean,
that's not the one the trial court issued an order on.
What?
That's not one of those the trial court has an order on limiting some of that.
They say in their brief that there is merit to our argument that discovery ought to be bifurcated. They say, however, the trial judge took care of it. Let me tell you how she took care of it. Their original question was, name all persons having knowledge of relevant facts. And they say because Judge Parrish changed that to read, identify all purchasers, sales managers, and finance insurance employees having knowledge of relevant fact, that she has somehow bifurcated discovery. Submit to the court as an absurdity. That question...
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Would you agree that the discovery issue is moot if the other side gets up and says that they are willing to limit discovery pre-certification to only discovery that relates to certification?
We've given them something even more liberal than that, Your Honor, and they've refused to take it.
What have you given them more liberal than that?
We said primarily related. We haven't said exclusively related. We've said, you know, we can live with something that says that is not primarily related to liability and damages. They won't buy that. I feel confident they won't sign off on what you just proposed.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. John Smithy will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, the counsel. I'm joined at the counsel table by Jill Hayes, and to address Mr. Chief Justice, your inquiry about a potential conflict, we have no problem with that at all. I just want to address that first of all. We've raised...
If we were hearing this at some point after a class certification, then we'd have to look more closely at whether or not we had opted out and such.
Yes, we haven't briefed that in any detail, but certainly we have. We would not raise any objections to any justice on this court. We've raised several procedural issues that I won't go into great detail. First of all, we alleged in our original petition that notice wasn't even required under 17.505B because of jeopardy of limitations, because clearly there were certain members of this putative class whose claims would be lost to limitations if a 60-day notice were given.
But can't you kind of get around those problems in class action cases? There seem to be lots of class actions where limitations doesn't even get involved because it is a class action.
Well, I think limitations is told from the time.
Well, is it true to say the only reason why there's a big issue about notice is because it's a DTPA claim?
That is correct.
If you just sued under some common law cause of action, we wouldn't be here on that issue.
That's exactly right. Right.
So you want the benefit of whatever the DTPA provides and their position, but you hadn't given us the notice that's required.
But the DTPA specifically provides that its limitations is a
jeopardy
issue.
I understand that part of it, too. But if you're trying to do this for purposes of a class or putative class, then and limitations rarely have an impact on who the class people are when it's all said and done. Why is that argued today?
It's really, I'm not going to argue in any detail, except we put it in procedural. We don't believe we were required to give notice under the DTPA. Because of the invocation of Section 505.
Well, did you tell them how many people might be barred by limitations, and that's why you didn't do this? And have you just raised this now, or was that argued in the trial court?
That was argued in the trial court in response to their motion. That's not a real big issue as far as we're concerned, because we went ahead and gave notice after the automatic debate. In fact, we've given notice twice. And we'll do it again if this court tells us to.
The argument is more profound. I mean, they're really saying that you have to give notice on behalf of the class representatives first, and if the defendants choose to settle with them, that's it.
That's the issue in this case, and that's why we're here. And in our judgment, Your Honor, that would be very bad public policy. It would contradict and contravene what the legislature has intended. And I say that going back to 1977, you'll recall that there were at one time specific provisions in the DTPA regarding class actions, and those were removed in 1977. And there was this big discussion that maybe the legislature intended to do away with DTPA class actions.
Which they could have done.
Could have done it very easily. And you could have done it any time since 1977. And the legislature is very seldom oblique in terms of changing something as drastic as this would be. But Justice Polk wrote an article and said, I was there and I know what happened, and that is the legislature deferred to the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court decided to promulgate Rule 42. And it was the opinion of both the Supreme Court and the legislature that you shouldn't have both statutes and rules that deal with class actions. And so as a result of Justice Polk's article in the Baylor Law Review and in some later cases, Mahoney versus Cup, it's just been assumed that you have DTPA class action in Texas. And that's never changed, either by case law or by legislative action. So that's where we are. Now, there were some 1995 amendments to the DTPA regarding notice that we talked about earlier in argument, and they do provide some logistical problems in maintaining a DTPA class action. It certainly doesn't show an intent to abolish class action. It just caused a little bit of a problem because of the two sections that one gives a defense and the other gives a mechanism to make a settlement offer. If this court were to do what the realtors are suggesting, it would create a number of policy problems. First of all, you're going to create an inherent conflict between putative class representatives and members of that class. Because you're going to require that conflict to occur. If I'm a class representative, I file a suit on behalf of the class, that their reasoning would require me to settle my claim, maybe at a premium, just to do away with the class. And opposing counsel said that not every class action will be disposed of that way before it is ever certified. I would suggest that the only ones that would be the ones with merit. Because a defendant who knew that he had a class action problem, he would settle with those named plaintiffs and the demand letter. Why not settle for a few $100 to avoid a very large class action? Because typically DTPA cases involve smaller claims with a large number of potential class members. And so you would virtually eliminate DTPA class actions there may be a few, but any meritorious class actions would be eliminated.
Let me ask you this. Why does your position not require us to, in effect, legislate from the bench by basically engrafting onto the current wording of the DTPA, or at least the wording of the DTPA as it existed at the time that's relevant to this case, language that would allow this type of class action to proceed because of the notice standards that are in the specific language of the statute? In other words, if we are going to strictly construe this statute, why is it that you do not lose?
Well, I think if the court strictly construes the statute, we win. And I'll say this, that first of all, the legislature passes law. And sometimes those laws work the way everyone envisions, and sometimes they don't. Now, let me give you an example. The original DTPA notice provisions that were in the DTPA suggested you had to give notice before you filed your suit. And there was this question, what if you don't give notice? What happens? Do you lose your suit? Is it dismissed? And this court, through the Sheps case in medical malpractice and later through Hines versus Hash, said we're going to devise a way to make this statute work. And it did. And it wasn't inconsistent with the statute, but it made the statute work the way it was supposed to without involving any unintended consequences.
Well, explain to me how, if we strictly construe the notification requirement of the DTPA, it would result in a win for your side.
All right. The Section 17.505 says that before you file suits, you have to give notice advising in reasonable detail the consumer's specific complaint, which we believe we've done, and the amount of economic damages, which we believe we've done. It doesn't require us to say that we'll settle for that amount. It doesn't require us to say that. It just says we have to advise of those specific amounts and those specific complaints. We've done that. Now, the America Online case is probably the only reported appellate decision to deal with this. And I think America Online dealt with it in a very logical and reasonable way. I don't think it's got any history in this case. It's a very recent case. But in America Online, what the Houston Court of Appeals, I believe it was 14th, I'm not sure, said is that in a DTPA case, what you do is you make you allege what's required in the statute, and then you include a demand that the defendant settle with other similar situations. And the court said the defendant is not being entitled to be relieved of liability unless it not only offers to settle with the named plaintiff, but also with other similarly situated. And that's what the Houston court did, and that makes sense. It doesn't contradict the statute. It doesn't involve law writing. It simply involves a mechanism to make the law work, and it prevents the elimination of class actions by the court system under the DTPA when that's clearly not the legislature's intent. So that's what you do. You just simply, you write your demand in accordance with 17.505. You tell the defendant if you want to settle this case, you're going to have to settle with not only us, but the others similarly situated. And they then are given the benefit. The defendants are given the benefit of Section 17.506 on the defense. And they're also given the benefit of Section 17.5052G to make a counteroffer, to make an offer. So,
you made an offer to settle on behalf of the whole of the class?
Yes.
How is that possible if the class has not been certified?
Well, any settlement.
By what authority are you attempting to settle on behalf of the class that's not been certified?
This is commonly done, and it's done in the federal system. Newberg, the kind of the Bible on class actions, talks about how many times class actions can and should be settled, not only prior to certification, but even prior to filing of a suit. And Newberg says that what you do is you enter into settlement negotiations on behalf of the putative class, realizing that you have no authority to enter into a binding settlement. But you arrive at a preliminary settlement agreement, and then you have to take it to the court for approval by the court.
That's not because of a shakedown. It costs less in the long run to do it that way than to litigate. I mean,
as far as the defendant's concerned?
Yes.
But that's a possibility.
I mean, and so this overly broad request for discovery is a tactic to force a settlement.
It can be, Your Honor. We don't believe that's the case here. But I'll get to the discovery. I can get their map. We limited in the trial court. Our position has always been we don't want a lot of documents. We don't want. I don't even place to put a lot of documents. And I don't have to go through a lot of documents. Now, there is certain information that's essential to us in order to be able to certify the class and also to have the venue here because they're going to have to take place before class certification.
Can you zero in on that particular language of the trial court order that Justice Regano read, one of the name of the salesman, and anybody that had anything to do with the transaction? At first blush, I don't have it before me. It seemed overly broad.
It's broad. But we asked just a general interrogatory that's asked in virtually every lawsuit that's filed in this state, and that is state all people with relevant information, who possess information, just along the lines of Rule 162.
Can I interrupt? Who do you say this class is supposed to be?
The class is defined as individuals who bought automobiles from new automobiles and paid the dealer.
Why do you need any more names than that from any particular dealer?
That's what we need.
Okay, why are you insisting on the purchasers, the salesmen, the sales managers, the insurance people, and all that? What do they have to do with your class certification?
Each plaintiff, Your Honor, in the context of this lawsuit, is suing each defendant on the basis of a conspiracy and concert of action, because all of these dealers...
But when you say that, then that goes counter to the argument you're looking for merit discovery rather than class discovery when you're trying to talk about conspiracies and so forth.
Well, not really, because in this issue, in order to get to venue, we have to get through venue. They play motion transfer venue. We've got to make some element of prima facie proof to get past the venue hearing, and that's going to involve showing a concert of action or a conspiracy. Now, if it's not as full-blown as a trial would be, but we've still got to have some evidence to give the court to show that there was a conspiracy or concerted action involved here. Right now, we don't know who these people are. And we asked the trial court, we agreed with the trial court, limit it to what we need to get our venue issues done and our certification issues. Because we frankly don't want all that discovery right now. We don't have anything to do with it right now.
But it seems like the identities of all these people and documents that can show it is a lot of information.
Well, it may be, Your Honor, but let me say this, that this is an area of very wide discretion in the trial court, and the workable rule this is not something that this court has time to do or needs to be doing, is going through specific items of discovery and determining what should be discovered and what shouldn't
be. Well, what's supposed to be heard by the trial court first, the venue or the class certification?
I think in this case, the venue probably would be the first due order, and then certification.
So are we really arguing about discovery in connection with venue hearings or discovery in connection with class certification?
Well, in the trial court, we assumed we were arguing about both. I think everybody kind of assumed that we were arguing about venue and anything certification and prior to certification. But
is there an impact on how this case gets here if it has to do with venue discovery as opposed to class discovery?
Well, in many areas, those are related, intertwined.
Well, no, but then we get into that little juicy situation. Is this a mandatory venue and you can take it up by mandamus or you have to appeal and so forth? Does that make a difference on why you're here or why can you be here?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the way it was argued in the court, that argument was never presented in the court.
So really, it's just purely a discovery?
Yes. And
between the two of you, should this be limited to who the class is going to be, and should any discovery about that be limited to that issue without any merit?
Yeah, and we've agreed. We don't want anything. We want everything we need to get the class certain and to get through venue. Anything beyond that,
and get through venue, that's another little hickey you put on.
But that's probably our first thing that we have to do is get through the venue hearing. And then go to class certification. Now, anything beyond that, we don't want right now. We don't need it. We don't want it. We don't have a place to put it.
How is your position different from the defendant's statement of what they would agree to if they promised?
Well, It's different in this regard. We've said that, so U.S. Supreme Court and the Fifth Circuit have wrestled with this, and they say, you know, it's really hard to know what discovery deals with certification and what deals with merits. I mean, how do you decide? It's so much of it. They use the word intermingled and intertwined. It's all intermingled and intertwined. This comes up in every class action case. And so what we've said...
Those calls of the language primarily related. They offer the language primarily related to.
Okay, and then they presented us with a list of things they would not produce under that agreement, and it was everything we had asked for in our interrogatories, virtually everything. If we were to agree right now to primarily related, who decides that? Well, I assume it would be the trial court. That's going to place an enormous burden on the trial court, not only to decide, well, does it relate at all, but is it primarily related to merits or to class? And what if it is primarily related to merits, but it's something we need in order to prove our class?
Do you concede that the order is overly broad, giving you a lot more information that you need to certify the class?
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't, and I'll tell you why.
Well, I thought you conceded that a moment ago.
Isn't the only order you hear on that notice the motion to order and the motion to protect the order?
Yes, that's the only one.
And we're not talking about the order ruling on the objections or not. The only thing that's been complained about in this mandamus is the denial of the motion for protective order.
Yes.
Is that motion for protective order in the record?
I believe it's in the record.
Okay. And it just asks for bifurcation in general terms.
Yes.
And we have the separate order that deals with the specific discovery items and ruling on the defendant's objections, granting some, overruling others, modifying discovery requests. That's not part of what we have here.
Yes.
Do we have any basis in this record to determine that, in fact, the discovery still remains overly broad?
I don't believe so. That order wasn't challenged on mandamus. Now, that's how the trial court chose to deal with this, was through objections, ruling on objections rather than dealing with the motion for protection.
Do we have any kind of an evidentiary record that supports any kind of decision one way or the other with respect to the trial court's ruling on whether something was overly broad or burdensome or anything?
No, that's the point. You could get mandamus relief in this court, but you've got to make some kind of record. You can't just come in here with a shotgun to shoot a lid off a china cup. You've got to narrow it down. And if something is overly broad, what you do, you go to the trial court and you say, Judge, they've asked for all these contracts. They may need this information, but we can get it to them this way. If we provide them all the contracts, it'll cost us $2 million. It'll involve 2 million documents. We can give them the same necessary information that they need by giving them a computer list. And if that's the case, then the court probably does abuse its discretion.
But the trial court's already refused to bifurcate.
In general, denying the motion for protection. What she decided to do was to deal with the objection on a piecemeal basis rather than just do a bifurcation order on the motion for protection. But in a sense, she did bifurcate because she excluded a great deal of discovery, both by agreement from our side and also on her own action, that didn't relate to the class certification process. So we simply don't believe that there's been any predicate laid in the trial court to come in and enable this court to be able to make a decision in that regard.
You mentioned earlier that you were sensitive to the concerns that sometimes discovery can be used basically force the defendants to absolutely capitulate. And here your letter says there might be as much as, or maybe more than $20 million in damages, which comes out to $33,000 per defendant if it were all, I'm sure it won't be, but if it were all divided per capita. That's not a very large sum before the game's not worth the candle anymore.
On damages or attorney's fees?
I thought it said $20 million. Is that just the attorney's fees?
No, that's not attorney's fees. The original damages were the average class member is going to have damages somewhere between $20 and $50.
Your letter said the total amount of the claim to be in excess of $20 million.
At that time, that's what we estimated it to be. But as you heard a moment ago...
That's $30 million less than your 1996, which is 50.
Yes.
So is the class getting smaller?
No, I'm confused now about which letter that is.
Well, the 1996 letter says we believe the damages are in excess of $50 million.
I'm not trying to argue. I have a question about
okay.
It. And whether it's just take 20 and then we go to 50, but
At 20, it's 30, if it came out distributed per capita, I know it won't be, but it would be $33,000 apiece. But that's a fairly small sum of money to hire a lawyer and look for these documents before you think, well, $33,000, I might as well kick it in the pot and go on down the road. Why isn't, at least in this case, at least on the verge of that, what you mentioned earlier, you didn't think it was.
As far as being a nuisance where you would settle to avoid the expense of litigation?
Yeah.
Well, there are going to be cases like that where a defendant makes the election to settle what he believes is not a meritorious case to avoid the cost of litigation. And that may be one of the expenses that we have to pay as a society to have a free and open court system. We have dealt with that in a number of ways, both in the legislature and in this court, through promulgation of rules to get away from frivolous suits. In this particular, but we don't want to end up in a situation where where we eliminate meritorious suits or we eliminate class action, because certainly in some cases, and including this one, where you have a large number of plaintiffs and a relatively small amount of damages per plaintiff, the class action is the most judicially economical way to resolve the complaint. And the courts, not only in this jurisdiction, but every jurisdiction in America have recognized it.
What on the operative letter here, what amount of money would you take to go to victims of the suit?
Well,
I can't tell by reading it, and I heard you say later you didn't have to make that specific number, but how is the...
Are you talking the latest letter?
Yes.
Okay, so in the most recent letter, what we did was we told them that it could be resolved if they would refund all of the taxes they had collected from all class members, and they would pay attorney's fees of $110,000 and cost to date of $49,000.
But you can't tell them how much that is.
We don't know. We have no idea. Now, they know, because they are required by statute to keep those records and to keep them for a period of time. Those records are made confidential by statute. So we don't have them. We can't get them, but they know what it is.
If they paid your $150,000 and the $150 to the five class representatives and signed, sent you a letter, we agree to refund, would you go away?
If they agreed to refund to the entire class?
Yes. They just wrote you a letter, so we agree we will refund.
Yeah, well, we would, except we'd have to get approval by a trial court. And possibly even higher up to do that. No defendant has been to settle a class action without getting court approval of the settlement. So I can't tell you that
and what would you ask the court to require to approve the settlement?
That's really not my decision. There are other lawyers involved. But personally, I think what we've asked for is that if they would just refund the amount that they've charged on this dealer inventory tax and pay a reasonable attorney fee, which is going to be high in this case because there's been a lot of work and a lot of documents and a lot of defendants, that we would want to settle on that basis and would agree to settle on it. We would recommend to our clients that they settle on that basis and recommend to the court that settlement be approved.
Any other questions? Thank you, Governor.
Thank you.
May I have leave to allow Mr. Perlmutter whatever time we have?
May it please the court, I want to pick up on a couple of things that were suggested by some of the last questions, particularly the abusiveness of the level of discovery that we're talking about here. According to the National Economic Research Associates, the average class action settlement is somewhere around 4 to 12 cents on the dollar. Now, when you consider that...
But that's not before us.
No, but Your Honor, the point I'm suggesting is, if I might, is that the fact that you've got such small claims here and such potentially wide-ranging and expensive discovery, that just reemphasizes the point that as a practical matter, allowing the pre-certification discovery deprives us of an opportunity to present our case on the merits because it's so expensive.
How does this record show that the trial judge, not every class action is pending. You are asking to mandate us to order the trial court to bifurcate discovery in a very general motion with no evidentiary record and with another order that purports to rule on your objection, limit discovery in some respects, order discovery in other respects. accounting on this record, have you shown that the trial court abused her discretion?
Your Honor, I submit that the way the trial court abused her discretion is that as a matter of law, when you've got a rule, as we have, that requires that a trial court proceed to certification as soon as practical, and if the trial court, as a general practice, violates that rule by allowing discovery on the merits of the claim.
But how do we know that the trial judge is allowing discovery on the merits of the claim and that it's overly broad based on this record when you have not brought before us a challenge to her order on your objections and have not briefed for the court how these particular rulings violate that rule?
Your Honor, we specifically challenged, we made a motion for protective order on that, Your Honor, and we specifically got a ruling on that motion for protective order that denied the relief we sought, which was to essentially bifurcate discovery.
And you have another order in which your objections were ruled on, and in a lot of circumstances, your objections were sustained and the discovery was disallowed.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think if you take a look at the trial court's rulings when considered together, what that means is that the trial court was specifically denying our bifurcation motion, and that's what we're asking the court
to
rule on.
How do we know that without a record showing us with respect to the objections that, in fact, those objections did not actually result in the bifurcation of discovery?
Well, the way you know it, I submit to the court that the way you know it is because we asked for specific relief in this particular motion, and that specific relief was denied. Now, I can't tell you that you know necessarily whether those objections that were sustained or objections that were overruled allow too broad a discovery. I can't tell you that that's there.
And in fact, could allow narrow enough discovery to accommodate what your concerns are in this case. We just don't know one way or the other.
Your Honor, I will tell you that they don't.
Well, I know, but on this record, I understand that's your opinion, but on this record, how do we know one way or the other?
Your Honor, I'd ask the court to permit us to provide a supplemental brief, if necessary, to answer that question, because I don't know the answer off the top of my head. But I do know that very clearly the court denied our motion for protective order on bifurcation.
Do we have any evidentiary record in the trial court with respect to the cost of the discovery that's been allowed or in what manner it is overly broad? Any evidentiary record made by the defendant?
I don't recall that was made, Your Honor. I don't recall that.
What specific rule or principle did you say the trial court didn't follow to bring about an abuse of discretion, and what can we find where that's in the record?
You're talking about on discovery, Your Honor?
To find an abuse of discretion, don't we have to find that the trial court violated some rule or principle?
That's correct, Your Honor. And certainly with the DTPA, this court said in Hines versus Hash that if the court denies an abatement improperly, it's not following the law and the mandamus will lie. That's an abuse of discretion. There's a failure to interpret the law properly under the DPPA notice letters. With regard to discovery, the court simply fails under Walker versus Packer and the basis for seeking mandamus for overly broad discovery issues there. Essentially, the trial court has allowed, by allowing merits discovery to proceed at this point, the trial court has allowed abusive discovery to occur to the point where we basically lose our right to present our case on the merits because the cost of discovery is so expensive.
Well, you're going to face that anyway if the case is not, quote, dismissed for some reason.
Well, that's only after certification. That presents a whole other set of circumstances. And I'm not even sure that at that point, that kind of discovery would be appropriate.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments in this morning's cases. All of those cases will be submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.